You've seen her fly, now watch her move to a brand new network. The CW has a new hero when Supergirl lands October 10th. It's the season 2 premiere of the show critics call pure blissful fun. This season, the Man of Steel will finally be revealed. Supergirl's Melissa Benoist teams up with Tyler Hoechlin, the newest Superman in the DC Universe. It's a superhuman family reunion when these Kryptonian cousins join forces in the fight for justice. And if you're wondering if the next president will be a woman, we have your answer. Because Linda Carter, the original Wonder Woman, guest stars as Supergirl's commander-in-chief. Even though Supergirl has her hands full fighting evil full-time, Kara Danvers is facing changes as challenges of her own. She knows what it takes to be a hero, but Kara is trying to figure out how to fit in with the human race while taking on a new job, new friends, and a new love who's out of this world. An evil corporate empire will rise that bears the name of an age-old nemesis, Luthor. Supergirl and Superman come face-to-face with Lex Luthor's next of kin, Lillian and Lena. And as you might suspect, the Luthor family shares a passion for power that can only be satisfied by a different kind of green. Kryptonite. Supergirl. All new episodes starting Monday, October 10th, now only on the CW.
Today on Anatomy of a Movie, we talk about the peculiarities of Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk. We talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Popcorn Talk Network on Anatomy of a Movie Show. Today we are dissecting Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, the Tim Burton adaptation from Ransom Riggs' book.
Very good, Marissa. Excellently said. Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here. Can't wait to talk about it.
And for the listeners, who are you?
What up, guys? I'm Jeff Graham. Thanks so much for tuning in to Anatomy of a Movie today. I just saw the movie, like literally an hour ago, so I'm excited to talk about it. If you guys want to catch me on other platforms, you can find me on AfterBuzz covering Atlanta on FX and The Good Place on NBC. So I'd love to see you there as well.
There you go. What's your Twitter handle?
Oh, my Twitter is Jeffrey C. Graham.
There you go. And you can follow me on Twitter at SerafiniTV. I am, of course, your host, Marissa Serafini. And Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. It is a mouthful, but I thoroughly enjoy this film. What were your quick thoughts of this film?
So, quick thoughts. I have read the book. I admittedly have read the book 3 or 4 years ago now, and I have read Hollow City. I have yet to read Library of Souls, which is the trilogy that Ransom Riggs based this whole mythology on. For the most part, I thought the movie was really, really excellent. I thought the movie got a ton right. I thought that there was maybe 15 or 20 minutes that the movie just got so wrong. But that's okay because I think this movie could have been pretty bad. And I think the stuff they got right, they got so right. So I was very forgiving of the third act, which I know we're going to talk about later, but...
We'll definitely talk about it. I enjoyed it. Admittedly, I read most of the book after I watched the movie. Mm-hmm. I read part of the book before and then due to scheduling and stuff, but I did read the full book. And now, having seen the movie 1.5 times and seeing and reading the book, like, I understand where you can think it went wrong. I see it more as where they took the creative liberals.
Great. I'm glad. I'll be interested to hear you kind of... I'm glad you think that, because it'll be fun to sort of compare.
Yeah. Unfortunately, like, I'm just a big Eva Green fan. Mm. She's amazing.
She's great.
And so I've seen just about everything she's been in. And, of course, I was going to see this, no matter what the story was going to be, just the fact that she's in it. And now knowing also that Tim Burton was directing it, it's like, you can't go wrong, honestly.
Yeah, this was definitely material matched to director pretty perfectly. Even when I read the book, I thought... If this were to be made into a movie, I have a feeling Tim Burton would really handle it masterfully. And 99% of the time he did. Yeah, I thought it was great. And quickly, I also want to agree with you that the performances were excellent. So I'm excited to talk about them.
I think so, too. I mean, Eva was great, and Judi Dench for the short amount of time she was on screen for. I really liked the different children and the different abilities that they had, or peculiarities, as they like to call them. But, you know, overall, I just enjoy the story because I'm a big fan of fantasy, and I think it's not something we haven't seen before, but I still enjoyed their take and their different spin on it that it still made it seemingly individual and memorable in their own way.
Absolutely. I did think it had a pretty fresh, and for a movie that could have felt pretty recycled, I thought it felt pretty fresh. So.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about a little bit about the development of this, because we know the trilogy book series written by Ransom Riggs, but it wasn't actually long after the release of the first book that Riggs sold the screen rights to 20th Century Fox to already be adapted into a film. And it took about 5 years, Riggs said, and he said the perspective was mostly the waiting and the writing of his second and third book, and to see if, like, they can make a movie out of this.
Yeah, I wasn't surprised that this movie got optioned, so, or this material, the novel got optioned so quickly, because the book is so inherently visual. For those who don't know, the book was actually developed, I'm sure we'll get into it a little bit, but Ransom Riggs actually is a photograph collector, and so the book was developed around the photographs. So there was already such a visual component to the material. It makes a lot of sense that a studio saw the potential of it for even a potential franchise.
Yeah, and even Tim Burton mentioned in multiple interviews that he likes looking at photographs too, and vintage photographs, and this book already garnered his attention just by, you know, the concept of these vintage photos that are in the book that are automatically attracted him to just the story and the characters, and then eventually naturally into the movie.
Yeah.
Which I really find interesting, because you can definitely tell artistic directors and creative directors and whatnot, especially Tim Burton as the creative genius he is in and of himself, like how people get their inspirations to create their next film or next big project, and knowing that he kind of like goes to books as inspiration for potential film adaptations. I like that.
Yeah.
Really nice. But yet the writing, we obviously had Ransom Riggs with the novel, but the screenplay was by Jane Goldman. So it was adapted by a female, which I liked. And I feel like in this film had really strong female perspectives.
It's interesting. One of the reviewers early compared the book to X-Men First Class, which she actually wrote that script as well, or at least I think contributed heavily to the story development of that movie. So it's, yeah, I think there was a lot of cogs that were working to assemble the best team possible for the development of this film.
Absolutely. And, yes, I've heard from a lot of people, they would compare this or make this a mix of Harry Potter and X-Men together. And I can definitely see those comparisons. People always pull from previous things to understand what they're currently seeing. Yeah, I definitely see it. And we can talk about the similarities between that. People would think X-Men with the individual powers or peculiarities, as they call them, like the ability to float, have the control over air, fire. We've seen that with X-Men. We've seen there was one of the villains in the movie that had the ability of ice. So you had the
shape-shifting.
Ice. Yes.
Well, and even, you know, oh, shoot, what's the name of the character with bees? Hugh. Hugh's character almost has an element of Froggy from, like, some of the older X-Men movies. Is that right? Zach, I'm saying that right, aren't I? Our producer's a super fan of Marvel.
Toad?
So. Toad. Yeah, that's bad. I'm not as much of a super fan as Zach is, who's producing our show. But, yeah, Toad. Like, it's the same kind of quirky animal. Yeah, and I think in the way that X-Men First Class was kind of immersed in a 1940s World War II history, and kind of had these X-Men serving as metaphors for outsiders, this movie kind of had the same thing.
Yeah. And I wouldn't even really categorize it to just X-Men First Class, because there are so many stories in comics or graphic novels or comics or whatever you want to call them. Sorry, Zach, if I'm like totally getting that wrong. But there are other stories in canon to the X-Men and other than just the movie. So it's not just X-Men First Class. I think it's just the concept itself of having children with these individual powers and abilities being homed and fostered in this house for protection. Like that therein lies that concept of where people can get the similarities. But I liked it.
Me too.
It didn't bother me because I do like those stories, and if it works for X-Men, it can work for this.
Agreed. And it's enough of a unique approach that it does feel pretty different.
Yeah. And what I liked about it, because it was different and another element that made it isolated and stand out, was the fact that they had to live in a loop for them to keep living their days out, and whereas to keep the external things out to save them, protect themselves.
It's interesting. For the most part, until the last third of the movie, which we'll talk about, the movie was pretty loyal to the book, which I was happy with. It is funny, though, because I think it was easier for me to buy into all of the mythology and lore reading it than seeing it. I didn't really question the kind of ambiguities or risky plot decisions that Ransom Riggs makes in his original.
Yeah.
Whereas seeing it on screen, I had a couple moments where I was like, oh, this feels a little bit like maybe it's not totally working from a story perspective. Just the idea of the time loop, for some reason reading it, it was easier for me to kind of digest than seeing it a little bit, even though it was so cool. And like, so I love the element of how they showed us the time loop resetting. That was really, really cool. I'm sure we'll talk about it. But yeah. I kind of, the story for me, even excluding the third act, which was different in the movie, seemed to work a little better on the page than it did on the screen, I think, for me.
I think so, too. Absolutely. And we could talk about the book differences and just the explanation of the loops, because this is where the book is better and stronger and storytelling and understanding the exposition of everything. Because in the book, you can read what it looks like and imagine in your own imagination what it looks like when they're doing the actual reset. And I think it was so cool to see it visually, because time is really the only thing we can see visually in films or movies.
Right.
Or like, that's the same thing. Films and television.
Yeah.
That's where I think they do so well in showing time. Because when you're living every day, you can't really see the difference of a time.
Right.
But if you slow it down, speed it up, you can definitely visually see it.
Yeah, and for the most part, I do think the movie really got the look of the... Like, it's not uncommon for me to see a movie adaptation and think, oh, I pictured that differently, or I pictured it this way, but pretty much everything, in my mind's eye, they recreated it on the screen, at least for me.
Yeah, I definitely think it got the tone of what the book was.
Yeah.
It was a little bit slow in the book, to even slow to start, and we see Jake Portman's life and how he had his relationship with his grandfather and what he was doing day in and day out.
Right.
He seemingly was an ordinary kid. And then we know he's not. He's extraordinary.
Yeah.
But it was that slow buildup, but I think the movie did well as to show that he was a fairly normal kind of kid thrown into this world.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed it. But yeah, since we're kind of talking about the book differences, we know that there are peculiars and the explanation of hollow gas and the whites.
Right.
Whereas, they explain the hollow gas really well in the book. And in the film, they explain it in a different way.
Yeah. What did you think of the look of the hollow gas in the movie, first of all?
They looked creepy.
They did.
I would not want one of those following me or attacking me.
I got a little bit of a Stranger Things feel from the hollow gas, a little bit from the monster from that movie.
Are they tall and spiked tongues?
Oh, yeah, you haven't
watched
it yet.
I have not watched it.
Oh, it's so good. When you watch it, you'll love it. It is a little similar, kind of lanky, tall, and yeah, the tentacles. There's a lot of, like, tendrils are another thing that are common. And, the book differences, if I'm remembering correctly, because it has been a couple years for me, in the book, it's really the souls of the peculiars that the hollow gas feed on, right?
Yes.
In the movie, it was the eyes.
It's the eyes. And I think it was kind of a smart switch on for the film, because it's hard to tangibilize a soul.
Right.
How do you corporealize a soul?
Yeah, I guess Harry Potter did it with, like, mist, kind of, but...
Yeah, a little bit, or, like, dust, or...
I know what you mean, though, and it's very Tim Burton just to have it be organs. Like, I feel like if Tim Burton has a lot of creative control in this situation, I'm sure he was just like, let's have them eat their eyes, because the visual...
That's gross.
Right, just, like, the visual potential of that being the mechanism to feed these hollow gas is so Tim Burton.
Yeah. I think the book does a really good explaining the differences between the hollow gas and the whites.
Yeah.
Because I didn't really... get it or understand it from the film.
I didn't either. I had to ask you because you just read the book. I was like, okay, so at first I was remembering it as the whites were the ones who were actually able to recognize the hollow gas, because I'd kind of forgotten, and you reminded me, no, the whites
don't.
Are the hollow gas who have turned back into humans are now controlled, like Dr. Golan.
Yeah.
Or Baron.
Baron, Dr. Golan.
Yeah.
The whites are like the first stage of a hollow gas. They're the human form.
And the movie didn't even ever use the word white, did it? Like,
not
it didn't really,
really
explain. I kind of felt that whole story arc was a little rushed and a little unclear. And I had read the book, so potentially problematic, but that's okay. We can get there.
Yeah. I was trying to understand how they lost their eyesight, their vision. More so, like, during the whole experimentation, that's where they lost their eyesight.
Right.
But in the book, It was more so that's just because they don't have any souls themselves, that they lose human form.
Yeah.
They lose the ability to see.
One thing I did remember that was different immediately was that Emma in the book is the fire manipulator.
Yes.
And Olive is the one, the kind of pixie girl who can float because she's lighter than air. I will say, if I remember right, Emma in the book was pretty spunky and kind of rebellious, and I kind of missed that in the movie.
Yeah, I would say spunky, definitely spontaneity, spontaneous in ways, and she had a past relationship with Grandfather Abe.
Right.
When Abe was a teenager. So, and yeah, but did, now knowing those powers were switched between these two characters, do you think that added or hindered to the storytelling of the film?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't think it necessarily took away from the story. I think I missed Emma's personality a little bit, not necessarily her powers. But I'm not one of those people who gets so caught up in those minor differences in movies, because as someone, I'd consider myself a writer, and a lot of times you do need to make those choices because your job as a screenwriter isn't necessarily to completely retell the story, but to capture the spirit of a story, but still present the best, most effective narrative as possible on the screen. So I thought that was a small enough choice that I wasn't necessarily bothered by it.
Yeah. I wasn't too confused because it did come in handy with the whole shipwreck at the end in the film, that helped add to the third and explain, like, okay, her use of air abilities actually adds to, you know, the action that's going on. I liked the fact that they did switch it, the romantic relationships between the characters.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the book, it was Emma and Abe.
Right.
Whereas in the film, it was more Abe and Miss Peregrine.
Yeah, that was interesting.
The older.
Right. Yeah.
So, and I kind of like that because in the book, it might have felt a little bit
incestuous.
A
little bit. Yeah, I know what you mean. I was a little weirded out by that one. But I kind of got the impression, see, I don't know if I read it the way you did, because I kind of got the impression that maybe Abe did have something with Emma. Did I see that wrong?
In the movie or in the book?
She was talking about how she was so sad about these goodbyes when she said goodbye to Abe, but maybe it was just a friend thing.
Yeah, I think it was more of a friend, because we see different moments in the film where it's Miss Peregrine who was sending the letter to
Abe.
And Abe was older, and also just the phone call that Miss Peregrine got every day of Abe calling her, reminding her everything that he's okay, everything's okay. So, like, I saw the relationship between Abe and Miss Peregrine in the film more.
Yeah, the thing I got confused about, and this is these are the moments where I'm like, this was just a little more clear in the book. I kind of thought that Abe was actually aging in the time loop, but I guess he wouldn't be because that day is still resetting, so he would be the same age.
Yeah, he would be.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you're right. I agree. And it was a little weird in the book. I remember thinking, like, oh, Abe was with Emma? No.
So I was like, that was a welcome change.
Yeah, yeah.
Another thing was, of course, the villains. Samuel L. Jackson playing Mr. Barron, who in the book, Mr. Barron was just he was a bus driver that appeared in Jake's life when he was a kid. Didn't really play a big role, but he apparently was the same person as Dr. Golan. And Dr. Golan, that particular name, was the big villain of the book.
Yeah.
Whereas they switched the names in this film. So, did you like Mr. Barron?
Yes. I'm very excited to talk about. There's been a little bit of controversy surrounding that casting decision, and we were discussing a little bit before you went on air, but I thought Samuel L. Jackson knocked it out of the park. I thought he was great. It was fun to see him in kind of a different... I know he plays kind of the big, energy, rambunctious roles a lot, but it was cool to see him play something so distinctly otherworldly in fantasy.
I liked it. I liked he was in fantasy. He's always fun to watch, no matter what role he plays in. There were some moments that I felt like, okay, now he's just Samuel L. Jackson.
See, it
kind of took me out of the film because I know that's what he's capable of, as his personality. And I'm like, that's not his character, that's just him.
The few moments that I was taken out of it, I actually thought were problems in the dialogue. And for the most part, as we said, it was, for me, the third act of this movie that really fell apart. But when he kept criticizing Jacob's ability to be accurate with the gun, I was like, you know, I think even Daniel Day-Lewis would have trouble delivering these lines. Because I just felt like everything about the third act of this movie kind of sagged for me, including just the specificity of even the dialogue. I was like, oh, that's just, I don't know. I feel like they might have rushed this draft and rushed it into production because I feel like this could be better.
Yeah, I think there were some lines for Baron that I'm like, okay, this feels like very ad-libbed.
Yeah.
Eventually your breath is going to run out.
Right.
And you also need a mint.
I know. Like, or like the moment when he was like, you share a peculiarity with your grandpa, the ability to be annoying. I was just like, oh, God.
Yeah, so there were a few lines that I'm like, okay, is this Samuel L. Jackson or is this Baron?
Right. And I would blame that on direction and writing more than I would on his performance because I don't know. But I hear you. It did take me out of it. I think we agree on that.
Yeah, it did. But overall, I still enjoy Samuel L. Jackson.
Oh, for
and
sure.
I think he added as a fairly scary villain.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
He was a good adversary.
He was game, which I really liked. And we're going to get into the performances, but everyone in this movie was game. They really bought into Tim Burton's world and his vision. And with whenever you're under Tim Burton, I'm sure as an actor, you just have to trust because you're asked to do some pretty crazy things. Mm-hmm. And 99.9% of the time it worked here and it was great.
Yeah, I loved it. Let's talk about Eva Green.
Yes.
Miss Peregrine herself. I love Eva Green. I've covered movies here on Anatomy that had Eva Green in it. I covered Penny Dreadful and her sister, Network and AfterBuzz TV, where she's all over it. I think she's so great. She just embodied this character so much.
Yeah.
And seeing her in all these different types of genres and her acting ability, this is like so spot on for her and what she can accomplish in a role. And I just like, she's just gorgeous too. And I think she really embodied what I was reading with Alma Peregrine, like someone who can be strict but also compassionate at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought she was great. This kind of nanny role is very traditional in like these kind of teen, even Tim Burton-y movies, and it's such an important role to cast because you need someone who's warm and cold at the same time, kind of thing, or chilly and stern, but also, yeah, bursting with empathy and compassion, kind of like Professor McGonagall, or there's Nanny McPhee. There's so many examples of this kind of badass, stern, caretaking woman.
Mary Poppins.
Even Mary Poppins, of course. She's the iconic.
Tim Burton always said this is the scary version of Mary Poppins.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. And she was excellent, I thought.
I think she's great. When you were reading the book, did you envision Eva Green?
No, not at all, actually. I pictured someone older. Someone more like a Professor McGonagall.
Okay.
But that's not bad. Again, this was a choice that even... This is one of the few choices that didn't match my reading. But she made very distinct, bold choices. And for that reason, I thought it was a great performance and really worked.
Yeah. I loved it. And we've been reading the book. Peregrine, Miss Peregrine, is described not really as an older person, but someone who walks with a limp. Therefore you can kind of associate that with maybe like the older age. But I don't think age was an issue in this film. I think she really grasped this character and she's fantastic. And Eva Green herself says like, you can't say no to Master Tim.
Right.
And like, and for that, I like it. And she's worked with Tim Burton on Dark Shadows and they're saying Eva Green is the new muse.
Oh, interesting. Helena Bonham Carter, what's she going to say?
Yeah, watch out, Helena Bonham Carter.
I think they're lovers, Tim Burton and Helena Bonham Carter, so...
Maybe.
Maybe, who knows? We're not in the UK, we're in Hollywood.
yeah, but, you know, I really enjoyed it, and she was fantastic. Yeah. I was really sad that we got so much of her character and I liked, and then she went away for, like, the length of a Bible.
Right.
In this film.
Which, that happens in the book, too, if I remember right. We do kind of lose her. Is it just at the end, though?
Just for, like, a chapter.
I think I'm combining Hollow City. In Hollow City, she's down for the count for, like, the first third.
Okay.
So, well, they have her, but she's stuck in bird form.
Yeah, and that's what happens in the first book, too, that she's stuck in bird form, and she does get abducted, but they have to go after her. And they actually get her rather quickly before all the other Imbrines.
Yeah.
So, and, like, so she was... The character, Miss Peregrine, was probably gone for maybe one chapter.
Yeah,
but she was there even in the whole third act.
Oh, she was.
And the whole attacking and whatnot. So.
Yeah, it was a bummer because that performance was so magnetic that we kind of lost her at the end.
I was like, I just kind of want to see Eva Green.
Yeah.
It kind of helped that she did go away to make the kids stand on their own and fight for themselves. I liked it. And One other funny thing about Eva Green is like the irony that her character can turn into a bird, but she herself is actually afraid of heights.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Nice.
And Tim Burton apparently gave her a hard time while filming during that. So
interesting.
I enjoyed.
Tidbit.
Azza Butterfield, who plays Jake, what did you think of his portrayal of Jake? Was it everything that you were thinking when you read the book?
Yeah, I thought it was good. A character like this can be kind of tricky because you're sort of the Alice to the Wonderland, you know, where mm-hmm. you're the straight man surrounded by all the chaos, so you kind of got to anchor the movie. So I thought at times he was maybe a little overshadowed by the excitement of his co-stars, but that doesn't necessarily owe to his performance. I thought his performance was good, and truth be told, he was what I pictured when I would read Jacob Portman. So, yeah. I was happy overall.
I've seen As a Battlefield in a lot of other movies and a television show, Merlin, if you ever watched that, it's a great show. So, he definitely fills out the character of mm-hmm. that teenager who you wouldn't, not to say this in a mean way, but, like, you wouldn't really think twice about, like,
right.
that
he's
normal
not,
kind
of kid. He's not Taylor Lautner or whatever.
No,
yeah.
No. But... like, I like the fact that he himself realized he was normal, but he does have a mission. He does have a peculiarity, and he realized that he is important and essential to those children and the home.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed it, and how Azza Butterfield got involved in this, he read the script and the book around the same time. He actually read the script first, and then he read the book. And then he had a sit-down with Tim Burton, and both of them, like, just collaborated their ideas. And he went through a few of the, you know, typical auditions that one would have to do. And then he finally did a chemistry test with Ella Parnell, who plays Emma. And, yeah, he got it.
Yeah, I think that's common sometimes for directors to just meet with the cast before they even start auditioning. I know Linklater does that. He did that with Ella Coltrane for Boyhood. Just kind of sat down with him and then was like, okay, yeah, I think you might be right for the part. So
yeah, and I think it's good to have that moment with, like, learning about the people who you potentially could be working with for 6 months.
Right.
And you got to know that if you're on the same page from the start,
right.
you're probably going to be on the same page at the end.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed it. So let's talk about Ella Parnell, who plays Emma. She's been in Maleficent, Kick-Ass 2, one of my ultimate favorite movies, Never Let Me Go. People need to go see that right now. And she also read the script and book back in when this book came out.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I thought she was great. I think my slight disappointment with Emma's character was that it was so different from the book. But that doesn't owe to her performance. Her performance was great and she did the job. And she did have a bit of an edge. I thought she had the edge. Not quite maybe the edge that Emma had in the book, but she wasn't afraid to kind of push back. Kind of gave me a little bit of a young Emma Watson. I kind of saw a little bit of Hermione, the intelligent, resourceful. And
encouraging.
I thought, encouraging.
In the moments when needed.
Yeah, kind of classy. Kind of classy performance. And yeah, I thought she did the job. I thought she was good.
I liked her. I think she was obviously the... you can definitely tell those two were going to be, like, the couple in the movie, which, like, I'm totally fine with.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to understand her character, knowing that she had the ability to, you know, control air. But I liked how they added the fact that she also looked after Abe's possessions and made her more important for the exposition. And it's like, oh, this is the map that was entrusted to me, so you guys can... help and go find these hollow gas.
Right.
So, yeah, she did serve a purpose. I enjoyed it. But, you know, we had a little bit of Lauren McCrosty, who plays mm-hmm. Olive. I've never really seen her in anything.
She was good, though.
She was. I didn't understand her relationship with her and Enoch.
Oh, I kind of didn't either. I sort of felt like, in general, everything could have been fleshed out 5% more. Like, there was a big ensemble, and I thought at times, even though Tim Burton did a good job of making them vivid through his direction, the little time we got with them, I was a little bit confused. I was like, are Enoch and Olive... because, like, I think Enoch seemed jealous of Emma, I thought at first, because he was threatened by Jacob. But then it seemed like Olive and Enoch had sexual tension, too.
Yeah, that's like, I didn't understand if they were friends because Enoch's personality was so not welcoming,
right,
and unlikable. And I'm like, how is Olive with like this guy or potentially with this guy? And I didn't really see the relationship. I didn't buy into it.
Yeah.
And then even at the end when they're, you know, fighting all the hologas, and there was that moment where Olive might have died because right. she got frozen. And it kind of just stopped the movie for a second because Enoch had that moment like, oh, I did care for you.
Right.
And got, I don't want to say cheesy, but...
A little sappy.
Yeah, very sappy.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand the relationship because I didn't buy it from the beginning.
Yeah, I agree. I found it to be a little problematic, and that's okay. I mean...
Forced.
A little forced, yeah.
Forced.
Yeah. Well, whatever.
We talked a little bit about Samuel L. Jackson, but I was surprised that he was in this film. I didn't expect it.
Yeah, and I actually thought he was really, really good. I think both of us have identified a couple moments that we sort of took issue with. But again, like, I kind of chalk that up to a little bit of the writing, unfortunately. And I think with the material he was given, he did a really, really good job. I thought he was scary, but I thought he was kind of playful and a little sinister in the way that you would want a Tim Burton villain to be, especially in a children's movie. And I think, yeah, like, this could have been such a train wreck, this villain.
Could have been.
And I think he did a pretty good job. I thought he did, honestly, a great job with this character.
Yeah. I wasn't too afraid of him because there were visible elements that, obviously, this is kind of a kid's film. Right. And a lot of the young adults are going to watch this. So you can't over make him completely scary. So, like, his white hair in contrast with him. Definitely showed that playful, kind of quirky side that you can't take too seriously. Mm-hmm. But I did enjoy him.
Yeah.
Also, I enjoyed Allison Janney.
Yeah, she's back
in this film.
I know. I just saw Girl on the Train, which she features in a similar role. It is funny. She's in everything. Like, I know we talk about
she's
the 6 degree.
Woman.
She's work. I love Allison Janney, first of all. And, like, she always shows up as these amazing scene stealing bit parts. And I, for like the other day, I rewatched The Way, Way Back. Have you seen that?
I have.
She shows up in that movie. I just saw 10 Things I Hate About You again. She's in that movie. She's the principal.
Yeah.
People forget.
She is.
And that's what happens is you're watching a movie and you're like, I forgot Allison Janney's in that. I really
She's in so many things.
This, you know, the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon game?
Mm-hmm.
I really want to do that with Allison Janney because I really think she might win.
I could probably do that. Yeah, and
she's been in so much.
Yeah, and she always plays like the fun mom.
She's fun.
She's in the show mom, and then she was also in The Duff. She plays the fun mom
in
that
film.
Oh, what?
But like American Beauty, I just rewatched that, and she's in that.
Oh,
she's. Yeah.
I've seen that movie. I'm trying to remember.
She's the kind of really solitary mom.
Okay.
And like Ricky's mom, Ricky Fitz's mom.
And she's just fun to watch. I would love to meet her in person. But the interesting thing that I found that, because in the book, this is again another difference in the book, Dr. Golan is a man.
Mm-hmm.
And in the film, they made it a woman.
Yeah, but if you get Allison Janney, you put her in your movie however you can.
Yeah. And I think that adds to the twist in the reveal at the end, because you wouldn't expect it to be a woman. Most likely you wouldn't expect it to be a woman.
I thought it worked. Yeah, I was cool.
The cool thing that I found out that Zooey Deschanel, Miranda Cosgrove, and other people were also considered for this role.
Cosgrove.
Yeah, and they're like fairly younger than I wouldn't believe them. Like, maybe I could believe Zooey Deschanel, but as doctor.
I know.
Doctor. I feel like you need someone who's a bit older, more experienced.
I agree.
To make it a believable
I feel like I would have been like, are you sure you're not just going to, like, play guitar in Jack Black's band for Miranda Cosgrove? Like, it's just hard. It's hard when you see a child actress grow up to, like, move past. For
right,
me,
past
and I know that's
it.
Bad, but.
I get it.
Yeah.
I love Judi Dench in this
the
film.
The Dame.
Dame
Judi
Dench
showed up.
Playing Miss Havisett. I liked her. Uh-huh. And unfortunately, she had an untimely demise.
Yeah.
Which is, I was like, oh, you had Judi Dench, and then you killed her.
Yeah. They might, it probably worked. I wonder if she would have committed to a whole 6-month production schedule. Sometimes you think with these roles, it's almost better because you're like, we can bring her in for a week and get all the scenes we need and then send her on her way. It was kind of the same with Allison Janney, too.
Yeah.
So as much as it was sad to see her go, it probably worked for in that sense.
Yeah, and the character Miss Havisett isn't that big in the book, other than the fact that we know Miss Peregrine, when she was a child, she stayed at Miss Avocet's home. So right. Miss Avocet was like someone who's personally close to Miss Peregrine. Mm-hmm. Hence the reason why she went back to Miss Peregrine's home to seek shelter.
Yeah.
I like that. So it was just like a little backstory to Miss Peregrine. And
it was good.
All the inbreeds and that, the fact that they are a family and they look out for each other. I liked it. And this is Judi Dench's first collaboration with Tim Burton.
Is it really?
Yeah.
It surprises me.
Yeah, she's pretty cool. Yeah, let's talk about the production of this film, which I think Tim Burton did so well. But the DPs were Bruno Del Bonnel, and the production designer was Gavin Bouquet. But I loved how this film looked.
Me too.
It was colorful when it needed to be, and was dark and dreary and saturated when it needed to be.
Yeah, Wales was so gloomy in the best way. It was kind of beautiful. Tim Burton can get a little... This was perfect for him. Sometimes if he's directing kind of a serious movie, it can be a little bit like, whoa, like, why are there pink flowers? Or that would make sense, but... I think pink flowers, it would make sense.
Sure.
But like in this case, it was perfect because anytime he made these kind of over-the-top quirky decisions, it so fit with the production design, even the original source material. This was a beautiful movie.
It was beautiful. And I love the different locations that they actually chose to film at, because Tim Burton, he liked a lot of practicality. Mm-hmm. He liked the real sets, just like the home. The Miss Peculiar's home that they saw. So if you guys are listening on iTunes and in audio form, you should definitely check out the video because we're going to show some photos. And it definitely adds to the discussion, and you guys can follow along with us and download the rundown and pictures in the link below. So the actual house where they filmed was called the Torenhof Castle in Braschat, north of Antwerp, which is located in Belgium. But Tim Burton wanted a place that looked like a house, not a huge stately home or an institute. And he said the architecture was right, the pond around it, the garden, everything. So there's a few photos you can just skim through. It's pretty perfect. Yeah. They looked at a bunch of other different houses, too. There was one that was kind of had the feel, but unfortunately it was kind of... It was breaking down, and it just wasn't safe to just film in it for production standpoint. And so there was another option, too.
I thought it was great. It was just what I pictured.
Yeah, so you had the garden, the landscapes. They actually had the big bushes there that were trimmed into animal forms. Those were actually real. And the cool thing about this particular home is that when they found the property, no one was living there, and it was actually up to be auctioned off.
Wow.
And the studio was thinking of buying it just for the film, but many of the locals in the area actually just wanted, was interested in the villa, so they didn't buy it. They just, used it for the filming. But I thought it was pretty cool. And, yeah. And the castle itself has architecture, that slightly run-down look. In this particular photo, you can see Tim Burton and the children actually playing. So, yeah, that's the actual land.
Wow.
That's not CGI. That's the land in the area. And there's a whole garden shot as well. Pretty cool. And the interior design, there's no pictures for the interiors, but the furniture in all the rooms of the house are pretty. He says 90% of the furnishings you see in the house is real.
I love that Tim Burton still believes in the magic and the power of practical effects and staging, because you can still obviously create the look of a fantastical world by using sets and using locations. And he just did such a good job with the look of this movie, I thought.
Absolutely. There is a room. The house itself had the observatory, that garden area, and also the dining room, which we see when... that was in the actual house as well. Pretty cool. The whole town of Caernam, in the film, they had to change the actual town that they were working in into Caernam. And the team decided to add a few buildings and a graveyard to the actual town because...
Was it shot in Antwerp?
This is Caernam. I believe Caernam is actually the name of...
Oh, they actually did shoot in Caernam, Wales.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was really neat because if you actually see the photos, there's less buildings there in real life than there were in the film. So they actually built the external facades of buildings just to make it seem like more of a downtown area where there's a post office. There's, if you look over to the next photo, there's a post office and there's a graveyard that they added to it. And they even added a pub to show that, like, the locals are actually out and about.
It was too desolate. They needed to actually...
They needed to add more.
Wow, that's interesting.
which was really neat. I liked it. And the whole Blackpool scene... was not in the book.
Yeah, I could have done without this, but that's
really?
All right. Yeah, I know we're going to talk about it more, but I was just like, the movie and the book, I mean, the book has a sense of quirky believability and fantasy grounded in reality. And Blackpool, it was cool to go to Blackpool. I have some British friends. I used to work with a lot of British people. And I was pretty familiar with the culture of Blackpool, and I had a couple friends from Blackpool, actually. So it was fun to see Blackpool on screen, but like, what? Like, I was just so upset when, like, why are we, like, throwing cotton candy at the Hologasts and, like, I don't know, like, Enoch animating the skeletons. Like, it just felt like it was, like, rein it in a little bit. I was like, why aren't the kids fighting them? Like, I just felt like I was watching a CGI battle for 5 minutes. I was like, I'm watching CGI skeletons battle cotton candy covered CGI Hologasts on a pier in the middle of the UK. Like, this doesn't feel like it captures the essence of what I had read.
Okay, yeah, I believe it, and this is where it very deviates from the book.
Very
a great deal.
Yeah,
but I was, you know, okay with it.
Yeah,
because it was in a fun way of how they got rid of these Hologasts and not in the dark way that it is in the book.
See, I guess that's what bummed me out too. Is I was like, this is such a there's an element of tragedy to the book. I mean, like, it's framed by World War II. I kind of sometimes get the sense that there's almost a Holocaust allegory element because it's these outsiders who are persecuted for the wrong reasons, having to hide from vicious monsters. And when you immerse it in the setting of World War II, you do kind of get these allegorical feelings that it might be tied to a Holocaust narrative. And I love that. I love that the book doesn't shy away from the horrors of war and persecution. It kind of embraces it.
Yeah.
And so I was disappointed with, like, this sense of, like, silly fun. Like, I know it's a children's movie, but it just did not feel tonally aligned with what I had read or even seen for the hour and a half preceding it.
For the first hour.
Yeah. That's just me, though.
No, I believe that. And that's a very fair statement.
Yeah.
I did like it because it was fun and it just showed the kids, like, standing up for themselves because they literally have to fend for themselves because they don't have adults around them to protect them. It's them. And I think it was an innovative way for them to see the Hologasts because that was the whole, that's how Hologasts were so scary because they couldn't see them.
Right.
And the fact that you could delineate them with cotton candy, I think just added to it.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, it was a way to handle the choices they made.
Yeah, understandable. But the cool thing about the Blackpool area is that, yes, they filmed on the pier with, you know, the different angles and the tower, but there was no pier.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there was actually no pier. And there are shots, and you can see in this photo, it's just the tower, but the pier that goes out into the water, they actually had to CGI that in.
But there is a pier in real life, right? Or no?
They filmed. I believe they created their own pier.
I'm sure from a logistics standpoint of shooting, it's it would be very hard to shoot.
A very small soundstage.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think it was really... that's cool. I never thought of that, you know, while watching the film. Because I don't really know the Blackpool area. So I was like, oh, yeah, there's a pier there.
My British friends kind of describe it as like sort of like the Vegas of the UK. Or maybe more like Atlantic City. It's kind of like Atlantic City.
Okay.
Yeah.
I get it. Yeah, and the cool thing about the whole underwater tank with Emma and Jake when they're swimming down to the ship, that was actually filmed at the Pinewood Studios water tank. Mm. And the cool thing about that is that it was all CG, obviously. But when they were filming it, all the walls were painted green.
Oh, wow.
And it was obviously filled with water. And Azza and Ella actually did their own swimming, their own stunts. And Ella Purnell, she could not swim before this movie.
Wow.
So it was very scary. And Azza Butterfield has very bad vision.
Interesting.
And so they're both swimming with their eyes open. So Ella can't swim and Azza can't see. And all the walls are painted green. So this is kind of what the tank looks like.
Oh, wow. But
imagine all the walls green.
Well, this worked beautifully. I thought it was shot well. I thought it looked right. And mm-hmm. I thought the kids performed it well. So,
yeah. And as I said, it was definitely challenging for him because when you're in water so often and you're surrounded by green, there's no depth of field.
Oh, yeah.
So he didn't know he could, like, make out, like, where Ella was while they were filming, but he couldn't really see anything else. So he said it was quite challenging for him.
I would think so.
Which I think was cool. But also, other than just visually, the locations of it were pretty cool. The costuming of this film was pretty on point.
Winning!
Colleen Atwood. I mean, she's a winner. Yeah. She's won. This is her 11th time working with Tim Burton, so they have a really good relationship. She's known for Edward Scissorhands, Sweeney Todd. I mean, so many movies. But yeah,
it is a little bit lucky.
She's won Oscars.
Oh yeah, you do get a little lucky though if you're a costumer and you become Tim Burton's disciple. Mm-hmm. You know that every project is going to be. And granted, you have to be so talented. But there, it's sort of like you hit the jackpot. If it's like, oh, Tim Burton's like, oh, in this movie we're going to be in the middle of Wales. We're going to have these. It's just. She got a nice gig developing that relationship with Tim Burton.
And she definitely had fun with the different costumes and whatnot. She said for the Miss Peregrine's look that she said she looked at pictures of a particular bird, the peregrine falcon bird, which almost had a shoulder in its own way that was pointed and elongated and an Edwardian shape. And so she took that as an influence and she made like pointed shoulders and a long tail feather, so like a really long skirt,
mm-hmm.
pretty much. That was pretty, pretty cool. And so you can see the photo, the concept art of Miss Peregrine. And then we had little Claire, but the blonde Goldilocks,
oh,
pretty
yeah.
much. She said, Colleen Atwood said, that the actresses, her eyes are slightly further apart than most people.
Uh-huh.
So Tim Burton wanted her to look like a saccharine doll.
Oh, interesting. I'm setting up the book in case.
Oh, there you go.
As a nice centerpiece.
For those who are watching us, we do have the Miss Peregrine's
Home. We also have one person in the live chat. Let me see. We've got Thomas Dew. Hi, Thomas. If you have any questions,
feel
free to send them our way.
There you go. And for Miller Nullings, he's the invisible kid.
Yeah.
They're like, how do you visualize someone who's invisible?
This was so fun, I thought, and they did such a good job.
That was smart.
Yeah, including him. And it's funny because the only asset you have and the thing, and this is the costume, obviously, which was great, but mm-hmm. also the voice of the character. And I thought they voiced him very well.
I think so too. He'll like, just listening to his voice, I can picture like the small, probably skinny kid mm-hmm. Who's kind of like meek but fun.
Yeah.
And they said for him that it's like, okay, how do you distinguish where he's located? So you put a hat on him. So you're like, okay, this is where his head is.
Yeah.
And when they were actually filming, they had to like pretty much put him on a wire stand just so like, people wouldn't like run into his area while filming.
Oh, or, like, that makes
run
sense.
Run into the character.
Like his head.
Yeah, his head. The whole eye line I thought was cool. Emma and her boots.
Mm-hmm.
what do you call them? The iron? Or was it iron?
I think iron. Lead.
Yeah, lead boots. That's it. Lead boots. Colleen Atwood said she had this idea to use 1920 ski boots. And she took the hardware of that and like plop took them off and then like painted them in different colors and gave it that iron look. And she thought the practicality of these boots that Emma would need, that like she could put them on but like quickly get out of them in certain situations, so you can like therein lies the clips on the boots, which I thought was cool.
I thought it worked beautifully. Yeah.
And and so, and conscious to that, her dress was also, like, light and feathery, so she can just float at the same time. Olive, with her fire abilities, she said they used different latex that had a different shine on it, so it could look like she's holding fire.
Yeah.
I think it's really cool. If you guys want to like keep checking that out, the cool photos there for you. Let's talk about Tim Burton, though. I mean, he's a genius of himself, but what did you think of Tim and his direction of this film?
I thought it was pretty perfect. My objections to the movie have more to do with story in the third act, but up until then, I thought sometimes Tim Burton can, I think, insert himself into a movie a little too much, if that makes sense, where, like, the director's hand is so heavy that it can kind of take away. Whereas here, I thought it was just perfect. I thought there was an element of subtlety that we don't always see in Tim Burton movies, but still his just brilliant quirks. And I was very, very happy with the direction. He does a great job with kids. I think Tim Burton does a really good job with children. And yeah, I was moved by all the performances in this movie, including the kids. So you did it, Tim. Nice job.
Good job, Tim.
Yeah.
And he said how he got involved was obviously he liked the book, and then but he said it was other different elements too, working with Eva again, and just the whole theme of being a loner and like feeling like you don't fit into society, but you actually do. He said that was very relatable, and he just identified that with a lot, well, and he got involved.
Big Fish is my favorite movie of all time. So obviously I like Tim Burton. I love Ed Wood. I love Mars Attacks. But he's made so many movies that they're not all going to be home runs. Mm-hmm. And I think this maybe for me would be in my top 10 Tim Burton movies, which considering he's made so many movies is good.
Yeah, so. I would say so too. I really enjoyed it. There were some moments where I definitely felt it was a Tim Burton movie, and I don't know why, because the whole scene where we see Enoch, like, revive the toys for the first time, it was obviously stop motion.
Right.
And it just felt so different from the rest of the
film. It was a little weird. I actually could have done without that.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I understand it, like, what Enoch's ability was, but I don't think it was necessary.
Right.
And I felt like it was just something to have in there just for fun. Tim Burton, he liked it himself because obviously he's well known with the stop motion, world. But he said he actually wished there was more stop motion, but it just takes so much time. I'm glad there wasn't. Because if you think about it, when Enoch was playing with the toys for the first time, it was all stop motion. But then when it came to that epic battle at the end and he revived all the skeletons that were obviously animated, but it was the same ability. I'm like, I don't know why they look so different when it's the same thing.
I know. Even in general, if you immerse stop motion in a live action movie, it's just going to have a look that kind of takes you out of it. So I didn't, that was the only choice I think he made that I could have done without. But yeah, for the most part, I think he did a really, really wonderful job.
Yeah. And I understood the movie itself, not really knowing the story yet.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but like, I think the adaptation, the first half was definitely true to the book.
Mm.
And then the second half, he definitely took those creative licenses in a fun way, though.
Agree to disagree.
Okay, fair enough. The music, actually not by Danny Elfman. You would think it would be, but it's not.
Just scored Girl on the Train, actually.
Danny Elfman?
Yeah.
Oh, good for him.
And Allison Janney's in that as well, which is funny. It's a very...
small world.
Yeah.
But we actually had Matthew Margeson, who scored this one. This is the third Tim Burton film not scored by Danny. And Elfman was unable to score this film due to scheduling conflicts with Alice Through the Looking Glass.
Oh.
That came out earlier in the year. But obviously, those two have a really good working relationship. Matthew's worked on other music for Tim Burton as well. And he was a musical director on a lot of Burton's films, which is cool. So the soundtrack will be released later in October of this year.
I thought it was good. I thought it was a good score. It wasn't too much. It wasn't overpowering, but it did compliment the movie. I thought it was good.
I noticed it at the end when they're all going away on the ship ferry there. And no words were needed. Let's talk a little bit about the box office of this. I mean, it had the budget of $110 million. So far, as of October 5th, it's garnered like $34 million domestically, and worldwide is about like $79 to $80 million, which that's pretty good, and it ranked number one.
That's good.
In the theaters.
How much did this movie cost?
$110 million.
They've got some work to do.
So, like, they still have a little ways to come back. But also with, DVDs, I think the great thing about Tim Burton and all of his films, they're definitely rewatchable.
Yeah, you're right.
And I think this film is definitely rewatchable.
Yeah, the thing is, when you have a director as bold as Tim Burton, he makes special movies that are worth going back to watch again. So, you know, the cult of Tim Burton fans regard almost all of his movies as classics. So I do think that this movie will have a life beyond just its screen run.
Yeah.
Its theatrical run.
And it has more stories to tell, obviously, too. But the reception of this movie is pretty high. IMDb gives it 7.2. Cinema score is a B+, which is a little low for the audience. But Rotten Tomatoes gives it 64 and 67 audience.
Yeah, it's funny. I was trying to think, if I had seen this movie without having read the book, I wonder if I would have liked it. Because even having read the book, I found myself a little confused at parts. And there was just, like, a lot of stuff happening in this movie.
It was.
But I had read the book, so I was fine with it because I could follow. But I'm not surprised that critic reactions to this movie have been a little lackluster, because I do think there was a lot happening in this movie that if you had no context for it, you might have been a bit like, wait, what? Like, you know?
Mm-hmm. There was a lot, but I understood just about...
Yeah, you went in without having read the book.
Yeah, having read the whole book at that point.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I understood the movie, but I think one of the... I don't want to say glaring issues, but one of the things that worked against this film, it was a long film.
It was long.
And I think the pacing was off.
Yeah, I agree.
There were some moments you can obviously pick it up faster or cut it just a little bit shorter. Because we see Jake, he keeps going back from the home to his hotel room, back and forth. And I'm like, he keeps traveling back and forth, but nothing's really happening yet.
Yeah. And it works in the book because they kind of developed his dad a little bit. But Chris O'Dowd did a good job with this kind of neglectful drunk father.
Yeah.
They could have pushed it a little more, though, I think. Pushed his alcoholic... Like, I kind of felt like in the book, I read him as, like, a straight alcoholic.
And oh, did you? Okay.
I did, yeah. And I feel like in the movie, he was, like, drinking and napping, but...
Yeah, well, like, also in the book, they explained the father, like, he was a motivated person who really wanted to go on this trip as well to work on his book, his bird book. And then when he found that the other guy was working on the bird book, he was like, oh, well, you know, he kind of lost his faith and hope, and then he just kind of got drunk because he felt bad that he couldn't complete his work. So therefore, all the drinking happened because he just kind of gave up on himself. But there was a line in the book that I actually really enjoyed that kind of really hit the nail on the head. Miss Peregrine's talking to Jake and trying to, like, convince him to stay at the home and, like, leave his family and his current life. And Miss Peregrine tells Jake, it's like, you know, your family may love you, but they'll never understand you.
Yeah.
And I was like, and that was kind of like a key defining moment of why Jake wants to stay with the Peculiars.
That was very well written in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Overall, I did enjoy this film.
Me too, for
sure. Would you buy this film?
Maybe. I like Tim Burton a lot. And as I just mentioned, Big Fish is actually my favorite movie ever. I watched that movie.
Really?
Yeah, it really is.
Okay.
Tim Burton movies work best, I think, when there is a very kind of sensitive emotional core. Like, he really cares about, like, the underdog. And, like, his movies at first seem like they're just these stylistic, quirky explorations of outsiders, but they end up having something really sweet.
Willy Wonka.
Exactly. Willy Wonka's a great
Edward
example.
Scissorhands.
Yeah, for sure. And they're not all, I mean, Mars Attacks is just off the wall nuts, but.
Right.
But yeah, like, I think this movie is one I would watch again. I think, yeah.
Yeah.
I think I'd buy it.
I probably would buy this film.
Yeah.
Overall, I did enjoy this, and I'm glad that we got this story out. Do you think this film was enough to garner another two films?
I think we're going to have to see what the box office does. The interesting thing is, I actually think Hollow City will be better as a movie than this was. I honestly thought
That's the second one.
This is the next one, yeah. I thought Hollow City as a book wasn't quite as good as the first one.
Okay.
But it was very even more extreme in terms of the visuals and the things. It's even more fantasy. So I kind of wonder if we're going to see even a better movie with Hollow City, because the text is lending itself, I think, already well to something on the screen.
Yeah. And, like, I liked all the children for their own peculiarities that they have. And I kind of want to just see them grow up and see what they're going to do with it. And maybe their powers get stronger and, see how they just grow into that.
Yeah, it's fun. They use their powers more in the upcoming books, but they still have the same kind of innocence of children. Like, it's like you see a lot more of Hugh in Hollow City, actually.
Okay, yeah, because we hardly saw him in this film. But, which was the funny thing about his, the actor who plays Hugh, he was also in Mr. Holmes. He played the child who was attacked by bees, which is ironic because his character
controls them.
Controls bees. So yeah, I really enjoyed this film though. It was fun.
Me too. I definitely think
they did.
I enjoyed
the book.
Yeah,
it was the movie was good enough for me to read the rest of the book.
Good. Yeah, so. for as bad as this movie could have been, they did a pretty good job. So I'm happy as a fan of the book. I think they did a good enough job with the movie. Good job, guys.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in and listening for our dissection of Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. In the meantime, where can everyone keep following you?
You guys can follow me, Jeff Graham, on Twitter at Jeffrey C. Graham. You can also catch me over on AfterBuzz TV covering Atlanta with Donald Glover and The Good Place with Kristen Bell.
There you go. And you can follow me on Twitter at Serafina TV. You can follow all of us on Twitter at The Popcorn Talk, and we're going to be talking about more movies. We're going to be talking about The Girl on the Train.
I think I'll be back for that one.
A lot of films and down the pipeline that should be exciting to talk about. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in, and we will see you for our next dissection. Some feelings they can travel to.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie. The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.